Alcoholic. You know, it's great to be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, to be able to come here and to participate in my recovery with you guys, to hear some great speakers, to be here at some workshops. We've got a lot in store for you this morning. And before we get going, let's acknowledge God's presence with a serenity prayer. Prayer. Conversation about a variety of things, as mundane as how the Braves and the Devil Rays are doing, to things that happened in our lives and the ways that we stayed sober over a period of time. And it's been a lot of fun just talking about a variety of things. It was a great workshop yesterday. If you missed Sandy's workshop, you need to get the CD, and that's one more plug for Bob. But now we have the great opportunity to have Sandy B. tell his story. So without taking any more time from Sandy from Tampa, we will let him go now. Sandy?
Thank you.
On.
There we go. Good morning, everybody.
Morning.
Is that on? You can hear me in the back? It's not on. Okay.
It is on.
It is? Is it on now? Good morning, everybody. My name's Sandy Beach, and I'm an alcoholic. And, God, that was great listening to that ukulele. Get things off to a good start. We sure have a lot of talent. I have seen plays and out in L.A. when Clancy used to do those Broadway shows, and they would change the lyrics to be AA lyrics, and they'd put on a whole 42nd Street or something, And I think that's just great, because it just means that we're committed to showing how wonderful life can be without alcohol. That there's we don't miss anything. It was an illusion that we needed it, because we have a new power, and it's much more powerful than alcohol, and it puts the creative ideas in, and people end up with talent they didn't even know they had and come in here and just do some wonderful things. I'm probably telling my story for the 4,000th time. I'm thinking of telling Lyle's story. Now, see, that was... Because, you know, I flew planes to save the Marine Corps and all that, and to... But anyway, I'll stick to mine. I do want to say I met a new friend, Sean, before the meeting, and it was really fun to meet him, and I want him to stay in touch with me. I was born in 1931 in New Haven, Connecticut, which means that my parents had just been through the Depression, and my father graduated from Yale University in 1928. With a civil engineering degree, and went out to work building a bridge up in New London. And in 1929, he was back home with no job, like a lot of other people. And fortunately, the university found some assistant janitor job for him to do so that he could at least put some bread on the table. And my sister and I never really wanted. Somehow my parents were able to make us feel like things were fine, even though as I got a little bit older, I realized with the stress that everybody went through getting through that depression. My mother was Catholic, my father was Protestant, and in order to, back then, if you're messing with the Catholics, you have to convert. There's just no compromise, or nothing's going to happen. So my father's parents, that took a while for them to embrace the Irish side on my mother's with her 9 brothers and sisters, most of whom were alcoholic. And on my father's side, my father would have a beer once a week. And then after a meal, he'd have 1 cigarette. You know what I mean? That was his, hey, I think I'll have a cigarette. And that would be the whole thing. So I didn't get my alcoholism from my father's side, I can tell you that right now. And so my sister and I were brought up in the Catholic Church, and my sister passed away about a year and a half ago. She had 32 years in AA. And once she came into AA, boy, I'll tell you, you get a lot closer than you were. It's just magic. You know, like when my daughters came into AA, it was just amazing. It's just something new that happens. And the reason I bring this up is that the two of us sat together, generally in the front row, in the front pew, and we both heard the same thing. We both saw the same sights. We both read the same catechism. And she felt like she was in the safest, most wonderful home in the world, sitting in that church. And to the day she died, she just loved it. It comforted her. She knew all the priests around New Haven. I'm sitting next to her feeling like I'm in Auschwitz. This place is not to be trusted. It's just the whole thing. They're not even talking English. I don't know what they're saying. The incense is going around and spraying around, and the confession. That was just the layout. I was back there about 5 years ago, and it still scares me to look at the confessionals in the back. It's all dark. And you went back there and sat, and then all of a sudden the door, little window, went boom. And you went, oh, Jesus. And I had figured out, don't tell them anything. Because they're going to use it against you later on the big day. When they add up everything wrong you've done, and there you are. So I would just say, well, I got mad at my sister once, and that's about it. Yeah. And the crowning blow was that I would sit and think about this stuff, and I'd read the catechism and find ways of scaring myself with it. And the crucifix was the crowning blow. I just was studying it. It's big, and it was hanging from right. You couldn't miss it. And I suddenly realized it just was like a shock that hit me. This is what God did to his only son that he loved. You know? What's he going to do to me? And I think I actually fainted with the shock of what was coming, what was in store for me. So you could say that my perception of the church was quite different than my sister's. And but we have no way of knowing that our perception is wrong, that this is something put together by me. And as we go through life, that's all we have, is our perception of it, because most of us are not in any position to be discussing these issues with anybody else. You know what I mean? I wasn't going to people. You know, when I go to church, I feel like I'm going to faint. It's the most frightening thing in the world. People say, you like church? Yeah, I like it. It's a good church. And I like going there. It's funny, but when I got into the Catholic Youth Organization when I was a teenager, and I got a phone call from some interfaith organization, and they wanted to know if I would join in with all the other different religions and have a meeting, and we could share with each other the differences and maybe get to know each other, etc. Well, I had no idea that you weren't allowed to do that as a Catholic. And when the bishop saw my picture in the paper, he called our priest, and I'll tell you, that was, whoa. There's only one religion. The rest of them you don't hang around with. We don't know what they're doing. There's just, this one is the right one, and let's not be associating with all those other people. And it was very, I remember the joke was, the guy dies and he goes to heaven, and they're giving him a tour of heaven, and he goes around and he says, "Now this is the Protestants, and they have this little, and they love to grow farm things, and these are the Jewish people, and they've got this, and they have..." And then they go by a group of people, and they go, "Shh." And they're very quiet till they get to the other side, and I said, "What's that?" And he said, "That's the Catholics. They think they're the only one up here." So I'm sure no matter what church I was brought up in, I would have misunderstood it, I would have missed the point, and I would have become uncomfortable with the idea of God. That's the point of making all this, is that I did not have any connection. And so when I got to AA, the idea of God was very negative. I didn't want anything to do with it, which I'll talk about a little bit later. When I was about 10, they had a polio epidemic, and I was at a boys' camp. About 90% of the camp got it. And we went into isolation. Nobody could visit you. And when the doctor first came, I saw him talking with my parents, and nobody would say what was going on. So we just were put in a car, taken down New Haven Hospital. And then we're looking out the window, and we're visiting down in the, you know, yelling down in the parking lot with our parents and stuff. And for a couple days, that was very, this is just my personality. For a couple days, that was very frightening and threatening. But the next day, I was having a ball with all the other kids in the ward. And then we got transferred up to Newington Home for Crippled Children. And I was there about 4 or 5 months, and I just thought those kids were so cool. They were on crutches. They could go up and down a flight of stairs running on crutches. I just couldn't believe these kids. They were just, you know, so it was like, I like this about my little mind, is that I can always find some fun in anything. And I still do, and I'm very grateful for that little gift of I would have it on jobs and places like that. And I had a job in Washington, D.C. many years later after I got sober, and I worked there about 10 years in the general counsel's office. I wasn't a lawyer, but I worked with him, and I wrote testimony and speeches and stuff like that. And then the Trade Association hired me away. It gave me more money, which was great. And I used to visit with these guys from the agency, and one day we were there, and the deputy general, this is the biggest compliment I ever got in the workplace. And the deputy general counsel in the middle of the lunch said, "Well, I'll tell you one thing. It stopped being fun to work here the day Sandy left." And to me, that's the best compliment that I've ever had. It stopped being fun working here. So if I have a gift that has helped me, it's that I just seem to be able to have fun in the middle of all this, whatever's going on. And I loved having fun. I loved practical jokes. I started getting involved in those at an early age. And I won't go into too many of them, but I do remember... They built the one of the first, not interstate, but like an interstate, was the Merritt Parkway in Connecticut. And it went through our little town of Woodbridge. And it went right over a road that I drove on to come home. It was a great big long hill to get up into the Woodbridge out of New Haven. And I don't know what got into us, but we started looking. You know, if we got up on that bridge over the top of this road and we made a dummy out of clothes and stuffed it with rags and then put a black rope on the dummy, we could have him standing on the side of the road like a hitchhiker, and at the last minute he jumps in front of the car and gets hit. And we pull him up. It was very good. We did that for quite a while. People would hear the brakes, and then they'd get out, and there's nobody there. So there's my little confession. One night we had a guy about a mile down the road with a flashlight that will signal us if a convertible was coming with his top down, and we were trying to get him in the drop in. And then we were going to cut the rope and let him drive off with a new passenger, but we never pulled it off. That So I did well in school, and my father, I got into the eighth grade, he transferred me to a little prep school that overlooks New Haven. They just celebrated their 350th anniversary. So, you know, up in New England, things are old. And it was a great school. Probably had 35 people in the class as opposed to the high school. And I loved it. It's one of the few places where I look back and I have just great memories of all the good teachers. And, of course, with small school like that, you can be on any athletic team you want because there aren't enough people to go around. You know, yeah, we need a second baseman. We don't care if you can throw or hit or anything. We just need somebody out there. So everybody got to play sports, and I enjoyed that very much. And I had a Spanish teacher. Languages came very easy. And I had a Spanish teacher who was from England, and he was the soccer coach, and I was on his, my first of men's story. And he was the soccer coach, too. So, number one, I'm getting all A's in his class. I would, you know, just do perfectly through the month. So he took a big liking to me, but I heard him talking to other professors that something about Pakistan really upset him. I just heard him talking, well, in Pakistan, whatever it was in the 40s between England and Pakistan, I'm not a historian, so I don't know, but something had him very upset. And I was reading a Popular Mechanics magazine, and here's this ad, learn how to speak Pakistani. Send away for this records and a book and a record player. So I decided to send it to him COD. And fortunately, I didn't tell any of my buddies. If you're going to do something, you don't want anybody to know. And I filled it out left-handed. You know what I mean? But I put his name in, his address, and then I waited and waited. And I finally said, it didn't work. They didn't send him. So I'm bringing coffee over to the professor's table at lunchtime. You have a tray full of coffees, and you bring them over. And I can hear him talking to another professor. Somebody send me these Pakistani records. I'm going to find out. I almost dropped the tray, you know. I went, oh, Jesus. So I just stayed clear. I never mentioned it, didn't say anything, but I would hear him talking to the other professors. How could someone send me Pakistan? They know how I feel about Pakistan. And he was really upset. I'm taking a midterm exam in a big study hall. In he comes with something in his hand, and he's going up and down looking at the handwriting on all the exam booklets that we're working on, and he's looking, you know, and I'm going, oh, geez, you know, so I tried to stay cool, and he comes by me and looks and keeps moving. 15 minutes later, a student comes in and says to the proctor up in front of the room, Mr. Blewett wants to see Sandy Beach. So the proctor came back and said, go down to Mr. Blewett's office. No. Oh, God. How the hell could this be? So I got in there, and he's sitting behind his desk, and he looks at me, and he said, someone thought it would be funny to send me Pakistani records. But I fooled them. I got the record. I got a hold of the company. They sent me the thing, and this is the order application. And I've narrowed it down to Fred Hitt, Bob Berry, or Marty DeGennaro. And I want your help in determining which guy did it. So I looked in, I said, no, that's not, no, Marty, see, he doesn't make it. So I eliminated the three of them. And after I graduated, he had never figured it out. So I went into Yale University about 4 miles away, and I was studying a lot of languages. So to earn some money, I could go up to this prep school and teach, when he was gone, teach freshmen Spanish. And while I was there doing this, I said to myself, you ought to tell him who did it. You ought to confess. I didn't know anything about amends or anything, but I remember saying the right thing to do would be to tell that man the truth. So I made an appointment to go see him. I sat down and I said, Mr. Blewett, do you remember the Pakistani? The word just got out of my mouth and he started choking, you know. Just, and I said, I don't know how to explain this to you, Mr. Blewett, but I thought it would be funny. I saw this thing in a magazine. I filled it out. I had no idea it would upset you this much. I just feel awful that I did it. And he looked at me and said, I can't believe that you would come up here and make up a story like that. Just to make me feel better. And man would not believe that I did it. So I think that set me up for unusual anticipation in step 9, that everybody would treat me like a golden boy and, forget it, keep the 10,000. Now, I had all this fun, I did all this, but I really, like every other alcoholic, I felt like, number one, I don't know what's going on. Everybody else does. Somebody got the playbook, they know what's going on, I don't. And everybody's better than me. No matter what I did, it wasn't good enough. And so I had that inadequate feeling. And when I met strangers or I met people who were richer or more intelligent or whatever, I would just clam up. I wouldn't say a word. So I spent a lot of time just with a lot of anxiety. And I get down to the university, and I had worked on their buildings. I did a lot of construction and that kind of stuff. And so the university was just another place to me. My father worked down there. But when I got in the freshman class and I started recognizing people in the class from newspapers, you know what I mean? They were rich and politicians and that kind of stuff. I went, what the hell am I doing here? This is a mistake. I don't belong in this thing. And I had this terrible feeling that the dean was going to call the 1,000 freshmen out on the old campus and say, gentlemen, we have an imposter in our midst here. And there he is. And then they would march me out of there so that they would just have the right kind of people. And I hadn't taken a drink. I don't know what it was, but something was telling me, don't drink, don't drink. I have no idea what it was. I wanted to get high grades, and I wanted to see if I could make the track team. And I went to an event where my name was typed up on the list. I was to go into this meeting room on the old campus, and there were 20 other names, and all we had to do was meet each other. Walk up, stick your hand out, and meet the other people. I started worrying about that a week ahead of time. oh, Jesus, meet the other people. Go, good. And I said, give it a try. You can do it. You can do it. I mean, this is how serious it was. I got there. I couldn't do it. There was no way. I looked around the room, and they had already broken up into three or four groups, and they're chit-chatting. And as I would look at a group, they would look back, and with their eyes, they would make it very clear, hey, we don't want to know you. I'm only kidding. I'm actually thinking of going over and then that group would look. And so everyone in the room made it very clear they didn't want to know me just through their eyes and body motion. And I just went, I guess I'll get out of here. That's the normal thing that I would do. They had a bar. And my roommates are saying, you ought to start drinking. You're in college. It's fun. It'll make you feel good. And I said, feel good. Okay. I'd like to feel good. So I got a drink and sat there talking to the bartender. And then I had another drink. I'm waiting. I don't feel good. I'm convinced that it's another joke. It doesn't work. And I was halfway through the third drink. I didn't feel a thing. And I said to myself, well, you might as well go. So I put the drink down. I turned around. Everyone in the room wanted to know me. It was shocking. They were just going, join our group, join our group. We want to know you. I'd like to be your best friend. Really? And I said, oh, my God. I never felt so welcome in my life. It was just magic. The world transformed. And as I started over to the first group, now I'm going to meet everybody. I started having the feeling they would be lucky to know me. And that was the transformation that alcohol did. And I went and I talked to everybody. And pretty soon they're leaving. And just like in later years, I'm going, where are you going? You remember doing that? Hey, we just got started here. We're going to study. We're going to study? So I went back and had about 10 more drinks just to see what would happen. And I got sick as a dog. I threw up all night. And I sat on the edge of the bed. Felt like I had a hatchet in my head. And the sun is coming up. And the thought occurred to me, are you going to drink again? A millionth of a second. I went, of course I am. This throwing up, and hatchet in my head, and feeling like I'm going to die, that's a small price to pay for what I had last night. So what alcohol did for me in that 30-minute period was so astounding and wonderful that without knowing it, I decided it was worth any price. Now you're an alcoholic. Alcohol is giving you all of the answers to life that were bothering you. It is solving all your problems. It's making you comfortable, happy. You can relate to people. It's the magic. And there may be a few payments you have to make along the way in order to keep this up. But I was willing to make them. And pretty soon, my grades are going down. I'm almost flunking out. I'm going nowhere near any athletics because I got other things to do when the day is over. And drinking became the reason that I was alive. I would go to classes, but it was just to get through so I could start the real day, which started at 5:30, when you'd walk into a bar or a fraternity house and start drinking. I just thought it was the greatest thing in the world. I started getting in trouble, getting arrested, going down. I remember the first time I was in jail, I went, look, this is a mistake. They don't really realize what happened here. And besides, maybe someday you'll write a book and you want a jail experience in there. So this is not. So I didn't see it as anything bad. And, you know, just all these things are going on. So I really wasted all those years. I mean, it was just one big bar scene. And I barely graduated. The numbers are so close to just flunking out. The Korean draft was still on for the Korean War, and a bunch of guys, we were sitting around drinking beer, and one of them said, let's go join the Marine Corps. And I said, yeah, all right. And I finished the beer. go down. There's six of us. The recruiting guy is thrilled. We're coming in six at once. And we all signed up and got sent to different places. And it's quite a shock when you first get in there. And, oh, my God, I remember looking at these sergeants going, hey, lighten up, guys. What the hell's going on around here? Right, Lyle? Just lighten up. Ooh, terrible. But after about 5 or 6 months, I'm learning how to be a platoon leader. I'm starting to like it. I'm starting to like the fact that I'm part of something and that this something is historic. It has a great history. People that are involved in it are very proud. And I said, you know, this is hard, but I think I really like it. And I saw some training movie about pilots. I had never been in an airplane, but they looked like they were having a little more fun than the guys in the foxhole. In the movie, in the training movie, they're at a bar. And they're talking with their hands, and they got white scarves on, and there's some blonde standing in the background, and I'm looking going, ooh. So I told this major, I said, I think I'd like to sign up for flight school. He said, no, you don't want to do that. You have to stay in 3 more years. I said, no, that looks like fun. So I passed the flight physical, and the next thing I got orders to Pensacola, Florida. I had met this wonderful woman in Madison, Connecticut. We got married, and we go on our honeymoon to New York, and then off to Pensacola, and I got airsick on the commercial airplanes. Going through Atlanta. You can't get anywhere without going through Atlanta. And then the old SNJ, I got sick in that, motion sickness, for about 4 flights, and so I'd be cleaning the plane out, and it went away. And once that motion sickness went away, I was in the right place. I started being number 3 in the class or number 2 as we went through acrobatics and formation and night flying and the carrier and the gunnery and bombing and all that. And then I went to Texas, got into jets, and pretty soon, after 18 months, I get a set of wings. The Korean War is over, and I'm going to a fighter squadron in Japan after 4 months training at El Toro in a Marine training squadron, and I'm a happy guy. I'm looking at this like, whoa, because the planes were going in. They were, after I got there, we got the FJ-4, which was brand new, right off the North American assembly line, and it was one neat airplane. It was the F-86 from the Air Force. And so El Toro was wonderful. The Marine Corps does not allow families to accompany. You go off by yourself for 14 months at a time. That's a typical Marine Corps tour. But the commanding officer over in Natsuki, Japan, sent the word back that if you want to pay for your wife's travel, they had made arrangements with an army base to get housing and furniture, and you could bring your family over at your own expense. So somehow we sold some stuff and got her a ticket, and my first son had just been born, so we have a brand new baby. I get there, I'm having a great time, and then 2 months later, she and the baby arrive. We get this house. And the commandant of the Marine Corps sent over a general on an IG tour of the Far East. And when he got to Atsugi, he saw the families there. And he said, what is this? And he said, oh, the commanding general of the 1st Marine Air Wing thought it would be all right. Maybe it was more the group CO. And the commandant said, send them back on the next ship. And so all the families had to be put on a transport ship. And I'm down at Yokosuka watching the ship pull out. And the Navy band is playing "So Long, It's Been Good to Know You." I'll never... And they got back there, and there were some of them got lawyers, and it made Life magazine, and the Marine Corps is doing this, and but they don't compromise on these things. A couple of the wives stayed there. They said, I got a tourist visa. I can go anywhere I want. So they transferred her husband to Okinawa. So she bought a ticket and went down to Okinawa. They transferred him back to Atsugi. So it was a losing game. Things have changed, but boy, I'll tell you, that was a very, it's our way or the highway. During that tour, I was with guys who drank as much as I did. I mean, the colonel would order the drinks at the table in the club. You know how normally when you're with a group of people, you have to sneak drinks because they're, you know, if they're ordering by the rounds. And you go, I'll be right back, I've got to go to the bathroom, and then you go by the bar. Give me two scotch and sodas, and, you know, and then you go to the bathroom. One, two, then you come back. You ready for another? Yeah, count me in. Yeah, I'll have another one. Because nobody drinks as fast as we do. Well, these guys were doing that, so I didn't have to do any of that. I just felt like we're all equal. And this major one day, the squadron was practicing carrier landings on the home field. And we were out there watching the guys, and he turns to me and says, you know, I'm getting promoted soon, and I'm going to have my own squadron. And he said, I want to get nothing but really good pilots. And he said, I want you in that squadron. And I'm a young lieutenant, and I felt so complimented. And he said, but I wouldn't let you drink. I did not ask him. I didn't say, what do you mean? I just pretend I didn't hear it, because I didn't really want... I don't think I wanted to know what that was. But he had seen that I was different. I'm in a group of very heavy drinkers who are drinking more than they would when they're back in the States because they're overseas. And my drinking frightened them. So alcoholics are drinking at a different level. We have more intensity. We're drinking when we have the flu. We're drinking. I mean, it's something frightened them about it, but I never paid attention. So pretty soon we ended up with six kids. I got transferred all around. I had wonderful duty assignments. And now the alcohol is affecting me because I'm going through withdrawals in the airplane when I don't drink for 10 hours. I'm at that stage where things are different now. You're in the much more advanced stage of alcoholism. I knew nothing about AA. The Navy did not have an alcohol program. There was no disease, nothing. So in spite of how frightening it was, I concluded that I'm going to have to do this myself. I'm going to have to somehow survive this. And on some flight, and I was in a photo squadron at Cherry Point during the Cuban Missile Crisis with the F-8. That was the photo plane that they used to go down there. And one flight would be fine. Then the next flight, the withdrawals would start, and my hands would start shaking. My peripheral vision would start to go. I'd start sweating. My heart would start racing, and I felt like I'm going to pass out. And I said, God, you're going to pass out. You know, so I came up with a plan of holding on to the ejection seat with my left hand, pull the curtain halfway, and all the camera controls were on the stick, so you could actually fly the mission with one hand. So here I am, up there like this, thinking that I've come up with the solution to a problem, that, and almost patting myself on the back, you know what I mean? Like, they almost had you, Sandy, but look at you, you outsmarted them. You're flying like this. And my theory was, somehow, if I started to go forward, I'd pull that. The seat goes out, and the chute opens automatically 10,000 feet. The plane crashes. I'm safe. What's the problem? So that kept me flying for about six more months, but it just kept getting worse and worse and worse. And eventually, there came a day. We had two kinds of airplanes. The other one was a radar plane, the old night fighter, the F-3D. nicknamed Willie the Whale. I think it was the first plane to shoot, a Marine Corps plane to shoot down somebody at night in Korea. Anyway, this plane was easy to fly. You had a radar guy over on the other side and straight wing. You couldn't miss landing. It was just so simple. So I'm flying back on across country, and I don't remember where we've been, but we're flying back Sunday to Cherry Point, and all of a sudden I have to get out of that plane now. I don't know if I think I'm going to have a seizure. I don't know, but something, I got to get out now. And it doesn't have ejection seat. It had some panel. You lift it up and you had to slide out the bottom. And I'm looking at it, and I didn't really pay that much attention how this panel worked when they were showing it. And I'm studying it, and then I went, this guy doesn't know how to fly. You can't jump out of the plane and leave the radar guy here. This guy has no idea what I'm thinking. You know, I'm looking around. So I called the flight leader, whatever his name, Dixieland 5-1, is this 5-3? So we have an oxygen problem in the plane. We have to land right away. And that's true, you do. If you have oxygen, because then you could pass out. So it was VFR. He saw an Air Force base not far away, and we all land. And I went over to the club, and I got a couple drinks, and I'm starting to calm down a little bit. And we go down the next morning to go back, and the maintenance people said there's no oxygen problem. And I looked at the plane, and alcohol said, do you want to give up drinking or give up flying? So I told the flight leader, I'm never going to fly again. And I've been flying, this is my whole life. I've been doing it for 14 years. And I love it. It's just everything. And I said, I'm not going to fly anymore. And he said, what? Why? I'm just not going to do it. I'm not going to do it. And I really don't remember how we got back to Cherry Point. Maybe somebody else. It's very confusing. And then the colonel wanted to see me. And he said, what's this? You don't want to fly anymore? That's right, colonel. I don't want to fly. Why? I just can't do it. I don't want to fly. And I would not give him an answer. But I also wouldn't fly. So he had no choice but to send the paperwork in to get me a new job specialty. And it took about 3 months. During that time, I did the legal work for the squadron, the special court martials and Article 15s and whatever. And I would not make eye contact with the other pilots. I just couldn't look them in the eye. There were 12 of them. It was a small squadron, and they had no lieutenants. It was all captains, a couple majors, and a lieutenant colonel. And I knew what they were thinking when they looked in. They go, how did that piece of junk get in this squadron? You know, I could just feel the ugh. So finally, I got my orders to be an air traffic controller, if you can believe it. And I leave the squadron, and I am so relieved that I don't have to be around those guys anymore. And I made it through air traffic control school here in Georgia, Glinko. And then went overseas. The enlisted men took one look at me and saw that I was not in any shape to do anything. So they said, Captain, here's your tent. We'll get you coffee. You got your bicycle. Captain, do not talk to any airplanes. You do not control anything, and everything will be fine. And I said, that's okay with me. Because it was over my head. I mean, I was starting to go down big time. I lost 50 pounds during that year to malnutrition, and I ended up coming back and having a grand mal seizure and going into the nut ward for 6 months. And out of that, I found AA. I had been in there for 3 months, and the neighborhood AA group in Bethesda, Maryland, got a hold of the head psychiatrist and said, you know, you have alcoholics in there. And he said, no, we don't have any in the Navy. There's no alcoholics. That's why they had no alcohol programs, and no one could be an alcoholic because there was no diagnosis of alcoholism. And they said, sir, you have some, and we could bring an AA meeting. And so he said, all right. So there were three of us. And the rest of the people didn't like us. They felt that our mental illness was not up to the level of theirs. So you knew you were low man in the nut ward as an alcoholic. And these people would say things like, well, you ought to just stop drinking. And I'm going, see that? That's why you're locked up in here. You think that's it? Anyway, a corpsman came in one night and said, all drunks fall in. We get in the elevator, we go down, and these guys are telling their stories. And I fell in love with them. And I went up afterwards, I said, give me your phone number. I said, if I run into a guy with a drinking problem, I'm going to send him around to see you. So anyway, eventually I became an outpatient, and I was able to go home at night and on weekends. Now I'm getting ready to be released back to active duty. And I had this thing that if you're watching the Redskins in my house, you have to be drinking a beer. And I remember it applied to me too. And I said, God, I guess I'm going to have to leave the game off. Won't be able to watch it. And I said, well, you could have one beer. Nothing would happen. So I had a beer. Nothing happened. I went to bed that night, slept like a baby, drove up to the nut ward on Monday. All the way up, I'm going, that drink didn't touch you. And I couldn't eat lunch. I was so excited because I'm a former alcoholic. First drink gets you drunk? No, it doesn't. I'm fine. And I couldn't sleep that night because of the excitement. And the next day and the next day. And if you want a good example of an obsession, that's it. All I thought about was the fact I had a beer and nothing happened. So on the way home the next week, I really preferred vodka. I decided to get a year's supply. I'd get a quart. And I'd have one drink, just like the beer. And, of course, the bottle's gone before the weekend is. Now I'm smuggling it back into the nut ward. I got it in my parking lot outside in my car. I know they're going to catch me. They told me if I ever had another drink, I'm out of the Marine Corps. So I called AA on Pearl Harbor Day, 1964. And there was one Marine at Quantico in AA. That was it. And boy, was he excited to have another member. So when he got to my house, there was no way I was getting out of not going to AA. I mean, it was. And he talked to my family. I didn't even go inside. I just stayed outside. I had changed my mind. And he came back out, and they had told him that I was a terrible father and an awful alcoholic and everything. So he just came out and said, get in the car. And he was an infantry Marine, explosive ordnance disposal was his thing. He's a real tough guy. And so I said, well, I guess I better get in the car, but I'm getting out of here. He took me to a meeting in Manassas, and it was a group anniversary, and the meeting lasted 5 hours. They had the group anniversary, then they had the food and all the cooking and the speeches, and then they had square dancing. They had fiddle players. People are dancing. I'm going, God. And I remember saying to myself, if you don't, and I saw they were all going crazy. They loved it. I said, if you don't get out of here today, you may never get out of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I decided to make a break for it. I'm out on the front porch of this old Odd Fellows Hall, and it didn't even have flush toilets. You had to take a deep breath and then go in, and you want to breathe in there. And I'm standing out there trying to figure out which way to run. There's no street lights. And an Al-Anon lady named Betsy Lynch came out. She put her hand on my shoulder, and I turned around, and she said, come on back in. Everything's going to be all right. And I believed her. It was just like that. That hand on my shoulder, it was like she was an angel or something. And all resistance left. I went back in, and I've been here ever since. Just amazing. Now, the flying story, I know we're getting near the end here. The flying story got extended about 3 years ago when I was out at the Brentwood Group in Los Angeles. And a lady was coming to get her 30-year medallion. And her husband was driving her to the meeting. He was not an alcoholic, but he was a big buddy of AA. And most of the time he'd stay for the meeting. But that night he was going somewhere and have coffee and read. So she's telling him the speaker is this Marine pilot named Sandy Beach. And he said, I think I know him. Tell him to come out here. So I go out in the parking lot. And there's a guy standing. I've never seen him. And he looks at me and he says, you know, in 1962, you were in a flight of four F-3Ds coming back to Cherry Point on a cross country. You declared an oxygen emergency, and you never flew again. And I said, God, how you know that? He said, I was in the plane with you. So I'm going, whoa. It turns out he wasn't a radar guy. He was an American airline pilot that had been recalled for the Cuban Missile Crisis. And he was explaining everything, you know, because I'm so confused. So he came to the convention the next day and he brought the photo album from that he had saved from that squadron. And he said, yeah, I said, oh, yeah, that's the colonel and this and that. And it was kind of fun to see it in a different light. And then he said to me, did you know how popular you were in that squadron? He said, it was killing us for you to leave. The colonel was going nuts. He was calling everybody to find out, what can we do to keep you flying? We had a flight surgeon who thought he had an answer and was going to be able to go against the, you know, get an exception while you did this. There was no treatment. But they were trying to come up with some kind of a plan. I had no idea they were doing that. And when he got through, I said, well, that's not how I remember it. So I had to go back 42 years ago and change my past. You didn't know you could change your past. Of course you can. You substitute the truth for what you thought was the truth. That's how it's done. And that story is so illustrative of our steps. And our old ideas avail us nothing. What do you think they are? These old ideas are false perceptions that you made about all aspects of your life and that I made. So I didn't just change my past about the VMC J2, the photo squadron. I changed it about my childhood, the Catholic Church, you know, my sister, my parents, people I grew up with, bosses that I had. And I went back and with the power of a higher power and the guidance of a sponsor and a loving group, I could see things differently. And I remember going to my sponsor on several occasions just going, Bill, the sky really is falling this time. Listen, and I'd go through the whole thing, and then the Marine Corps is going to throw me out. And then he'd go, yeah, I hear you, but don't forget, you've got 6 months now. And people love to hear you tell your story. You're really helping a lot of people when you do that. And now you're the coffee maker, and you bring the cakes, and the groups are relying on you, and you're in them. And I remember when he finished, I said, well, if you look at it that way, if you look at it that way, well, that's all that it takes, is to stop looking at it your way, have somebody help you see it differently. And that applies no matter how long you've been sober. When people come to me that I sponsor, with a problem, I have started maybe about 10 years ago to prove to them that they don't have a problem. We don't work on the problem. I said, no, you're wrong. You don't have a problem. And we go through it until we're looking at it differently. And so, see, the problem was you were looking at it wrong. Your perception was wrong. And then we re-examine it until they agree they don't have a problem. That's what the book means when it says, our problems, we think, are of our own making. I think I mentioned yesterday, anybody in the room have a problem that's not bothering them? So once you can stop being bothered by whatever this issue is that you came up with, it's no longer a problem. And you can just, it's been removed, it's been erased. And a lot of times it involves forgiving somebody else. And then you no longer have a problem. I no longer have it. That's the power of perception and wanting to live in the spiritual world. Let's see. I got a little more time. About 25 years ago, I was up in Washington, D.C., watching the news. And there'd been another murder in the neighborhood where the black kids lived, and the drug fight was on, and some innocent kid was in the wrong place at the wrong time, and he'd been shot dead that morning. And the reporters found his mother and stuck the microphone right in her face and said, "How do you feel about the boy that killed your son this morning?" And she said, "I've already forgiven him." I almost fell out of my chair. I had 25 years sobriety, and that woman blew me away with the level of spirituality that she was at. I had never even conceived that you could forgive that fast. And yet she did. And they kept talking to her, and they're going, "What?" I mean, the reporter was, he was in a state of shock. It was almost like, "You don't know what you're talking about. You can't be forgiving people." I mean, he was so mystified by the whole thing. But I kept looking at her. She was at peace with her relationship with the boy who had done the killing. And about 2 or 3 years later, you remember the Amish? And they had the shootings up there, and then they all went over to the family of the boy that done the shooting to comfort them. There's great examples of how these principles can be applied at a much higher level than we've seen before. And I used to talk about that. I bet I'd bring it up every year. I'd be talking to somebody, and I said, I still can't get over that lady I saw on television. I said, "That is the most amazing thing." I said, "You can forgive as it's happening." And then it happened to me when my daughter was murdered. And it was automatic. It was just, I saw that lady, and I just went, "Oh, whoever did it is forgiven." And the other thing that is important is very often things like that can cause us to have a little bit of anger towards God. How could he have allowed these awful things to happen? So I'm suggesting a couple of things. One is, when you get shocking news, you generally have a few seconds before you react to it. And you go sit down. You go, "Oh my God." And then you walk over, and now you allow it to come in. You know what I'm talking about? That's the way I have handled things. So during that period, you go to God and you say, "God, I want to talk to you before I react to this. I just want you to know that this will not change how I feel about you. You will always be the most important thing. I love you. This will not change anything." And then you go over and sit down and allow it to sink in. And, of course, God's right with you because you just made the huge connection. And you can feel the comfort as you deal with the sorrow. And it's very powerful. And that's why I brought it up in the workshop. is, if you weren't here, the suggestion is that you decide now to become a forgiving person. You don't wait for something to forgive. You decide to become, from now on, I'm going to join the ranks of forgiving people. And one of the first things I'm going to do when things come up, forgive. Forgive. And you'll be amazed how it'll come naturally. It'll become part of you. And so that's why I bring up that story. And my other daughter, two daughters died in 3 months. And my third daughter's in AA, and she had to deal with, she was there when all these things were happening. She never drank. She has 11 years sobriety and talks freely about these events and how the program allowed her to not even think of drinking and go through these type of situations. So in the last 5 minutes, then, I just want to say something to those of you that are new to AA. Our program is designed to give you a spiritual awakening so that you can be in touch with the creator of the universe on a personal basis, so that you experience yourself an awareness of your own creator. It's already there, you're just not aware of it. I remember sometimes in hotels they would have reading rooms where you could go in and you're waiting for somebody and you could take a book off a shelf and sit there and read it. They had great big overstuffed chairs and all that. I remember going in there, I looked around, and it's empty. So I get a book and I'm reading and I'm there about a half an hour. Suddenly I realized there's someone else in the room. You know what I mean? You weren't aware of them. Now you are aware. They were there all the time. But you're aware. And it's the same thing with this higher power. It's there all the time. It's right as close as it can be. There's nowhere you can be that this presence isn't there. If you work these steps, there's going to come a day when you suddenly become aware of it. You just, it's almost like it gets revealed to you. And you just go, oh. And that is the day that your life moves to another level. And my point is, don't miss it. Don't settle for just not drinking. Get to the next level. Don't cheat yourself out of what AA is really all about. And if you do this, you'll be talking about it when you give talks. And you'll be telling people, oh my God, I almost missed the whole point of being alive. I almost missed the whole meaning of life. I missed the whole damn thing because I didn't try hard enough to have this awareness kick in. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly, but it'll always materialize. So don't give up, and thank you for listening, and God bless everybody. I appreciate it.